Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Spinning the Reel. I'm your host, Evan.
And I'm your host, Zach.
And we are back again. Isn't it amazing? I don't know when any of these get released, but we are recording for like the third time in 4 weeks, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we only missed 1 week in the last month.
That's pretty good. We're back on track.
Yeah, somewhat. I mean, we're getting there.
Yeah. So we have a big show today, but I think we should talk about a little bit maybe what's going to happen going forward here. We've been working to get back on track here at Spinning the Reel. I've been cleaning up the website, and I think the important thing maybe to announce today is that we are going to be using Blue Sky a little bit more to promote the podcast and have conversations and things like that. I've been cleaning up the website and posting some old reviews and things like that over there on Blue Sky. So if you want to follow any of that, I'm at EvanD26.
I forgot my username.
I think you're Mind Vultures.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So join the conversation over there.
BlueSky.social or whatever. Yeah. It's a fun little place. Definitely a stark difference between whatever Twitter is now.
Whatever Twitter is now is a mess. But I think it's cool because it's kind of a small community.
Yeah.
And maybe we can do some like Blue Sky code giveaways or something.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a little bit neater in terms of like filtering content you want to see and things like that. And the way trends work is not really the same as Twitter. So it's, again, a lot better at capturing stuff. But yeah, so we're doing kind of like a soft relaunch because we've been on a pretty long hiatus this year, taking like months off at a time. So we want to get back on track.
Yep.
And really just kind of commit ourselves more to this because we enjoy talking about movies like this. And
we do.
It's fun to hang out and, you know, put our thoughts out there and hear what other people have to say. So
yeah, and that's the important thing. I think that's maybe the newest iteration of this podcast as we go forward, is inviting maybe a little bit more feedback and conversation as well, because previously we put things out at a sort of sporadic rate and haven't heard much back. And I think it would be good to have, that's the fun about movies, you know, you watch them and you have a conversation about them. And so we do that here, but we want to engage with, you know, other people as well too. So I think that's going to be cool. But as for today, we're going to have more to announce, I think, about how that process is going to work. But for now, we are going to talk about a couple movies and a couple of events. Do you want to expand?
Yeah, sure. So as always, we're big fans of the American Film Institute and the festival they put on every year. So this past weekend was AFI Fest, Thursday through Sunday. Your host, Evan, was able to go every day this year. And even attend some of like the premieres, right? You went to multiple premieres.
Yeah, I think two world premieres and then a couple like North American premieres or something like that.
Nice, yeah. I was only able to make it to Sunday this year, but I did manage to get on a full schedule on Sunday. And that's what we're talking about. So
yeah, what we saw on Sunday.
We started with a movie called The Bareti Flower, which we won't be discussing today, but is a very poignant look at some indigenous tribes in Brazil and their struggles maintaining their land and defending it from poachers. Kind of like a pseudo-documentary because it's got a narrative.
Yeah, it is definitely a narrative
but
based on the experience, and it is partially written by members of the community. So I don't know what you would call that, but like a narrative documentary kind of deal, and it's very
like good. An immersion narrative sort of.
Yeah,
but I think the initial title card says they were there for like 13 months.
Amazing, yeah. They went to five different villages, I think they said.
And so it's a beautiful movie.
It is really,
very,
really incredible,
very moving. And then we caught up with American Fiction,
the Toronto International Film Festival's People's Choice Awards, which actually has a very strong record of nominating movies for Best Picture. So the guy next to me who got a studio invite to American Fiction said that it was the front runner for Best Picture. Don't think he was right, but that's how you know. You should stick around to hear about American Fiction.
Yeah, that's written and directed by Cord Jefferson, who's been a writer on some great stuff. I can't say it's going to be a best picture front runner.
It might be nominated, though. It's got a chance.
Yeah, honestly, I think so. It's great. So we're talking American Fiction. And then the world premiere?
No, this is the probably just the American premiere, yeah. Maybe. I don't know. It is a screening of Maestro.
Yes, Bradley Cooper's Leonard Bernstein biopic.
Yes, it is. And yeah. We're going to talk about that. Yeah. In between, yeah. We're going to talk about a couple of the things that we've been doing this month. Zach has embarked on a journey through horror for October and watching 31 horror movies in 31 days. And you met your goal, right?
Or is I did, that... yeah. It okay. was actually a very grueling challenge, but I did it.
And I will talk a little bit about the other movies at AFI Fest, so stick around for that as well. All right, Zach, why don't we start with probably the bigger of the movies that premiered or the premieres that we saw, Maestro. I think that's probably the best way to start because mostly just because Bradley Cooper's directorial debut, A Star is Born, was this like huge success, nominated for a bunch of Oscars, kind of was surprising when it didn't win some of those Oscars. And so I think everyone was kind of looking at, what's he going to do next from here? Because, I don't know, like, A Star is Born has its faults and all of that, but it was pretty well directed, I think, and especially well acted. So Maestro was his next project. This was something that Martin Scorsese was thinking about directing for a little while. This was something that Steven Spielberg toyed around with for a while. And then they gave it to Bradley Cooper. I think the other two are still producers on the film. And he made this movie about Leonard Bernstein. Do you want to explain maybe the context of the movie or what it is?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's just, I don't remember where it picks up from in his life.
It picks up from the, when he takes over, I guess it would be like the New York Philharmonic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because
that's right. Yeah. So
the leading composer was sick and yeah. He gets the call. And then,
yeah, he's basically like the understudy, and then the main guy is sick, and he goes out there and acts as the maestro for the orchestra for that performance, and people are ranting and raving about this, like he is this
genius,
incredible conductor, and then that really is like the launching pad for the rest of his career, and then it follows him meeting Carey Mulligan.
That would be great if it was literally Carey Mulligan that he met. Like,
yeah.
I can't. Well, she's some like aspiring actress. I'll look up the name right now. Yeah. But yeah, he does. He meets her at a party. Mm-hmm. Her name is Felicia Montalegre, and she's an actress. She's a stage actress mostly, but it looks like she has some credits.
Yeah. To her name. They sort of have this budding romance, and then it follows their life together. And his career and sort of how that affects him and his marriage and his family and then his closeted homosexuality.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's a very drama forward biopic.
Yep.
But yeah, I really don't know else how to. That's like a basic synopsis of
what would you about. Think of it?
Honestly, I wasn't that big a fan.
Didn't care for it either.
Yeah, it's it drags in a lot of places, in my opinion. One credit I will give to it is that I think Carey Mulligan is a fucking star.
Electric. She's great in everything, yeah. But she's so good in this.
Yeah, just incredible.
I don't think Bradley Cooper's bad in it either. Like, I think he has to play this person from the time they're, you know, 20-something to, you know, his death. And I think the character that he makes out of Bernstein is excessively exaggerated.
Have you seen any interviews with the actual Leonard Bernstein?
I have not. I think I've seen clips of him like conducting and like that sort of thing, and pictures have kind of floated around in the release of this film. But I don't know. I did think that he was like not bad in it, you know?
I couldn't get over his voice. It felt so like inaccessible to me. I just couldn't see it as anything other than Bradley Cooper doing a voice, which is crazy because if you think about A Star Is Born.
Yeah.
Or even some other Bradley Cooper performances.
I mean, Rocket Raccoon, he's doing a voice. And A Star Is Born, he's doing a voice too.
Yeah. Or even something, you know, like Chris Kyle in American Sniper, which is...
You know, I've never watched that movie all the way through, and I never will. You haven't seen any
clips of it? Or
I've seen a few minutes of it.
He's doing a voice. And, you know, I remember particularly on, I think it was Fresh Air when A Star Is Born was on its Oscar campaign. I did an interview with Terry Gross and was talking about how he spent so much time with a voice coach modeling his voice after Sam Elliott. And
yeah,
here, I just don't think it works. Like, it sounds like Bradley Cooper trying to do a voice to me.
Sure.
And that made that performance just completely inaccessible personally.
Yeah.
So it was very hard to
focus. I will say something about me is I tend to care a little bit, unless it's like cartoonish, unless it's like Jared Leto in The House of Gucci or whatever.
Well, it wasn't like, that bad, but
no, like unless it gets to that level of like cartoonish, then usually I'm just like, all right, they're doing something, whatever. I just thought he conveyed this like conflict within.
It just sounded fine. Like he needed to clear his throat the whole time.
Yeah, that's true.
And then, you know, this has already, for the people who have seen it, and I'm sure for the people who will see it if they haven't yet, garnered a lot of comparisons to Tar, which I think are warranted.
I don't know if they are, though. Just because they're composers.
Well, I mean, but it, not only composers, but, you know, narcissists and abusers and...
Yeah.
Just this sort of, like, rise and fall, in a sense, of their career in the same exact, sure, you know, position and industry.
I just think Tar is so much better executed, and the
character... I mean, that's all you have to say. Yeah. That's the comparison that's happening. Yeah.
We were all waiting for Tar to show up at the end, but...
It's just, yeah, I mean, I feel like this movie is less than the sum of its parts. The individual choices and things are interesting or executed well, but the whole thing is together just didn't...
There's so many choices that are just made to make choices too. So like first
the black
maybe
and white?
Maybe third of this movie is in black and white, and then the last two thirds, can't remember exactly what the delineation. I don't think it was exactly half, but yeah, it's told in black and white, and then it just goes to color without really any rationale for the switch. It just seems like Bradley Cooper was reaching for directorial flourishes that he didn't need to do. I think that it kind of fails on just a level of like a Leonard Bernstein biopic. Like, I feel like a lot of it is about the relationship between them, but really so much of it is about him cheating on her or attempting to cheat on her with men. And that's, you know, a part of his life for sure, but it doesn't really propel the story forward in any way or get it any deeper meaning between these two characters. And I don't know, it's a very bizarrely structured movie, and I've seen people
it lacks focus, right? Like it spends a lot of time on these extremes, and really it in my opinion paints a really negative picture of Leonard Bernstein.
It sure does. Which is not a bad thing. Like, I don't think you have to be a positive, like, I don't think a biopic needs to portray its subject as necessarily admirable in every aspect or anything like that. It's weird that, I mean, we went to this premiere and his family was there praising how great it is, but it does paint their mom in a very good light. So, I mean, like that.
But I mean, they also, the first thing they said was like, they basically like thanked Bradley Cooper for telling this story and taking care of this legacy, which to me, in hindsight, is like, that's really strange, because I don't know how you could walk away from this like feeling good about how he was portrayed on screen. And, you know, they praise him as a genius. And of course, most people who are familiar with his work do. He's a very beloved composer and conductor.
You have a hot take about that, though.
Yeah, I mean, you just read my Letterboxd review where, again, and also coming off the heels of Tar, like, conductors don't do anything.
They just wave a stick around.
Yeah, I mean, they there's it's all cues and stuff. Right. But if you're, I feel like
an expert level musician,
you're not relying on the conductor. You know, you know your cue. I guess changes on the fly, maybe, but that's not it's not easy to depict visually.
Sure.
And that is not to take away from his ability as a composer, right? They spent a lot of time.
They talk about West Side Story, which he helped compose, and that movie is expertly composed.
Yeah, they spent a lot of time on him doing like his process, which is being an asshole to everyone while writing music. But
Way they use music though in this movie composition, is pretty impressive.
Composition is absolutely a skill.
True.
But just I don't know how it translates to conducting. And
yeah,
it's funny too, because there is a scene in this towards the end where it's like his Tar, or where Tar's directing like an anime concert.
Incredible scene.
He's teaching conducting and then is criticizing the student and then does the same exact thing.
And everyone's my God.
Genius.
Yeah.
And then he tries to fuck that student after. So just...
Honestly, though, before the trying to fuck that student part, I actually thought that was the scene that actually did capture the whole movie. Like, there was some talk. I don't know. We were sitting next to... a film critic, I won't say who, but we saw his review after and just raved about this movie. And one of the things that he and a lot of other people brought up were, or was this scene in the cathedral that people in our screening literally applauded afterwards, which I always think is a funny thing when that happens in a movie. But, very compelling scene. But I think the scene that actually does wrap it up is the one you're talking about, where he's teaching this class and just over and over telling the student how he's failing at this, and then he goes in, does the exact same thing, and everyone is in awe of his like mastery. And that's kind of all it is it's this guy that is seeking glory over and over again. But I don't think that the rest of the movie built up that same emotion as that one scene did at all. So like that was the thing, is like, if this movie was Tar to that degree, like that is what Tar is like self-aggrandization until the point of, you know, complete dissolution. And this movie only reaches that at a couple moments.
Yeah. What's particularly interesting to me about that too is in that scene, he's just kind of nitpicking, I feel like.
Yeah.
It doesn't even let the student finish what they're trying to do. They keeps interrupting because the way he's conducting, is essentially like bringing in the next section. It's like either the horns or something like that, where he's trying to transition from where it's a bit quiet and then it goes a bit grander. And Leonard Bernstein keeps coming in and is like, I don't think you mean to do it this way. I don't think you're meaning to do it this way. I think you're trying to do this. So you have to like control them and tell them and all this stuff. And then he's like, okay, can we take it back from this point? And then literally maybe three bars play, and then he's like, no, stop it.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's frustrating after the last 2 hours that you've watched at that point. So it just felt inaccessible to me. Like I couldn't empathize with this character very much.
Sure.
I understand.
Because a lot of the story, and I think the reason for that, is a lot of the story is told through Carey Mulligan's perspective, and that's great. Carey Mulligan is very good in this movie about kind of sticking by her husband as he does all of these horrible things to her and their family and that sort of thing. And you don't really get the opportunity to build up a rapport, a relationship with Leonard Bernstein, as portrayed by Bradley Cooper in this movie. So after, after he's alone later in the movie, you get left with this character that you basically see, I don't know if I'd say as a villain, but like as, like you said, a narcissist at the very least. And then you're asked to empathize with, his experience then. It's just, it's such a bizarre way to structure this
movie. If you're not familiar, like she gets cancer.
It's not really a spoiler because it's a real person, but
I don't know. I feel like I don't have a lot to say. I think it looks really good.
It's shot well.
Yes, the movie looks very
good. Again,
some
of the decisions that are made are strange, like the color change, like from black and white to color, is odd to me. Because it's not even like he meets Carrie Mulligan and then his world gains color. It's like, no, I like, well, after that, it's just like, all right, we're just switching to color now. And I'd be interested to see if Bradley Cooper has maybe said anything about why that choice was made. But, you know, I'm
well, someone, he hasn't really been able to, right?
He has, because he's been given an exemption as the director of the movie to promote and speak about it. He was at Toronto.
He wasn't at AFI.
He was not at AFI in solidarity with the strike, which is awesome. But he was at Toronto, but he didn't speak at Toronto. I'd be interested just to hear, because again, like, it seems like a flourish for the sake of a flourish, and that's when it kind of becomes a problem. Do you think this movie's gonna get some like awards buzz? I think Carrie Mulligan's probably gonna get some.
I mean, that's like recognition. I think even just after seeing the trailer, that was pretty much the consensus online, was this was like, you know, an Oscar bait kind of movie,
right?
And I think that's absolutely true. I think Bradley Cooper is going to get a nod. I think Carey Mulligan's going to get a nod. He might get a nod.
You think Bradley Cooper's going to get a Best Actor nod?
No, director.
Oh, okay. I was going
to No, not say. Actor. Best like, director.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm not even confident about that. You know, I think he's going to get a Best Picture nomination, possibly.
I mean, I feel like we may not even get have a proper award season this year.
They say that the strike is close, and this changes from minute to minute to resolving. But
I know, there was a letter that was circulating with a bunch of actors' signatures on it, like urging to make a deal. So
yeah,
who knows? But yeah, I could see Bradley Cooper getting a directing nod for this.
Yeah, we can run down it at some point, like who is in the mix. But I have a hard time seeing it.
Carey Mulligan, I think, is absolutely getting a nomination.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah. Probably score, maybe.
I think they did score it well and use music well. There's parts where they use the West Side Story score as like a background for certain scenes when it's like that period of time. And like, I always love when someone is composing something on the screen and it incorporates itself into the score. And like, this is another movie where he's like, you know, he's playing his piano a lot and that becomes like a backdrop. But
I also think Maya Hawke was really good in this.
Yeah. Underutilized maybe, but like, yeah, she is good.
But as like a, just considering other things we've seen her in so far, you know, she was in, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Yeah, Stranger Things is where she kind of blew up.
Yeah.
And then she had that cameo as like the Drew Barrymore character in Fear Street.
Sure.
But I feel like this displays a little bit of range, you know?
I think
at least the other cast members on Stranger Things, I think she'll probably have
She had a little head start, little Nepo more, baby and all, but
yeah, a little more longevity in her career. But I mean, I think she's talented.
Yes, least. I agree. I thought she was good in this too, and I'm going to talk a little bit about Ethan Hawke in a little bit, so good connection there. I don't know, do you have much else to say about Maestro? I think it's a misfire for me, you know? I don't think it's necessarily like poor intentioned or anything like that, but it's just, like, I'm not offended by this movie, I just couldn't connect with it
My biggest takeaway was just, it felt so inaccessible to me, the way that his character was framed and where it asks you to empathize with him at what points. I will give it another chance. I think when this comes to Netflix in like 2 weeks, I might watch it again.
Yeah.
If I have the time, but yeah, not for me overall.
Right. You want to round it up? Oh, I'll round it up first. Letterboxd roundup. I gave it 2 stars. This movie did not really work for me on just about any level.
Yeah. Yeah. I gave it 2.5. So.
Yeah. I think Carey Mulligan is at least 1.5 stars of that. So I will talk about AFI Fest, the rest of it. So you were there for Sunday. Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk a little bit about American Fiction in a minute. So I'll just run down the films that Anna and I saw while we were there. First one, world premiere of Leave the World Behind. Have you heard about this movie?
That's the Ethan Hawke one, right?
It is the Ethan Hawke one. Sam Esmail, the showrunner for Mr. Robot. Mm. That's something that you watched. I did not, but he has quite a reputation around. Julia Roberts, Mahershala Ali, Ethan Hawke. It's a big cast, for sure. And it's basically a disaster movie, like an end of the world kind of, I wouldn't call it a horror movie, but more of a thriller. And it's about this couple, middle class, upper middle class family, Julia Roberts, Ethan Hawke, and their kids do an Airbnb off on, I guess it's like Long Island or something, somewhere by the beach. And they go there and they discover that weird things are happening. They go to the beach and an oil tanker runs ashore right in front of where they're sitting, and they have to run for it. And the same night, this guy, Mahershala Ali, and his daughter, played by, let me pull this up. It's like Mahala, I think is her name. Yeah, Mahala. And she's the daughter of Mahershala Ali. They show up and it's their house. They're the owners of the Airbnb. And basically they are like, there was a power outage when we went back into New York and we came in, we felt more comfortable being here. And it sets the stage for this story about people trusting or mistrusting each other. Race comes into play. Julia Roberts' character is like legitimately just racist and doesn't trust these people because they are black. And Ethan Hawke is just chill, like, yeah, guys, come hang out. Like, we're all good. Everything's fine. And so it becomes a thriller about, like, figuring out what is going on, figuring out how to survive together, and figuring out that the only way to survive together is by working together. I liked it. Very mixed reviews, but I thought it was tense. We saw after that The Peasants, which did you ever see Loving Vincent?
No.
So that was the director's like claim to fame before. It was this animated movie that was using Vincent Van Gogh's art, or the style of Vincent Van Gogh's art, to animate like the story of his life. And they hand-painted all of the frames. They did this again with a movie called The Peasants. It's apparently a novel in Poland that is very famous. It was okay. Beautiful, very beautiful. They did the whole thing in oil paintings. So I think it's like worth seeing for that. Those two movies I have a review up of on the website. So one of the movies I think you would really enjoy, Zach, you loved Drive My Car.
Yeah.
One of your favorite movies of that year, was it 2021 that mm-hmm. that movie came out?
I think that was my number one of the year.
I think it was, too. We went and saw that together, right?
Yeah, in,
Frida. Santa Anita. And so the follow-up of that movie from director Ryosuke Hamaguchi, Evil Does Not Exist. Have you seen anything about this movie?
I've seen one trailer.
Okay.
And I really wanted to get to this one. I think it was playing on Thursday and Friday.
Had two show times. That's true. Yeah, one super late at night, one, more middle of the day.
Yeah. I couldn't make either, but this would have been the number one I wanted to see.
So this is a movie about a guy who lives in a rural Japanese village, with his daughter. His wife, her mother has died at some point, he is taking care of her, but he really loses track of time. He gets very absorbed into his environment, and he is very traditional. He's trying to keep the like traditions of the village alive. He collects water for the local noodle shop. He tries to protect the animals that live around and gathers berries, all of these things. That's like how he spends his day. He doesn't really have a job. He just kind of cuts wood and helps out the people in town. And they help him out in return. And then one day, this big corporation comes in and wants to install a glamping site on their land. It wants to put, luxury camping and one of the biggest problems that they have is the bathrooms that they want to put there. There's like a, what is it when they dig the hole and
Like a latrine or like a outhouse?
No, but like literally the system that they use.
Instead of a septic tank?
Yeah, septic tank. And like having it upstream from the communities downstream. Mm. And so this guy basically becomes the advisor for the glamping site, teaching them about the customs. And it takes some really crazy and interesting turns that to me were reminiscent of How to Blow Up a Pipeline. Okay. So I really think you would enjoy that. One of the best movies that we saw there. Watched a Brazilian movie called Pictures of Ghosts. People might be familiar with the director, Kleber Mendonça Filho. He did Baccarat, and he has this documentary basically about the death of movie theaters in Brazil. Really interesting. Went to the Q&A. He was a nice, interesting guy. We did a conservatory showcase, which is just basically like people that attended AFI Fest, which I will say that actually is one of the coolest things I think AFI Fest does that other film festivals don't, mm-hmm. is that the American Film Institute is a film institute and has students, and part of their showcase is they do a live action shorts showcase, they do an animated shorts showcase, and they do a what's called a conservatory showcase where they show off the films of like students that it's like their thesis film essentially. One of the ones there, we watched six of them, but the one I'll highlight is a movie called We Met at Camp, 15 minutes, but it is a very, very funny movie about these three girls who are in camp in 2004. And they are all talking about their crushes and the little knickknacks they were given at camp. And then one of the girls is gay and has an interest in one of the camp counselors. And the way she tries to hide it and the way she comes to terms with that being okay. It's very, very funny, very, very poignant. Probably the only one of the six that really indicates to me that this person has like what it takes to become something significant as a filmmaker, and I'm interested to see what maybe they do from there. Just a couple more before we get to the ones that we talked about. Freud's Last Session. Have you heard anything about this, Zach?
Only what you told me.
Yeah, so this is a world premiere. They did it at AFI Fest, and the film critic that I was sitting next to was like, it's very weird that they're doing a world premiere at AFI Fest. Not even in the big theater. And so this is Anthony Hopkins as Freud, and then Matthew Good as C.S. Lewis. Bad. It's just them talking about religion, but also it's not really about that. It's about Freud being sick and his daughter being gay, and it's super scattered, poorly shot, poorly constructed. Just all around a disaster. I would avoid it if you can. The Teacher's Lounge.
Let me stop you right there real quick. Yeah. You said that the last title card was a punch in the gut. Why is that?
Oh, okay. So, yes, that is a great question. So this whole movie is constructed about the idea that right before Freud died, he had this meeting with C.S. Lewis, and they discussed the merits of religion. And so... Sigmund Freud, famously atheist, did not believe in God. C.S. Lewis, you would know him as the writer of the Chronicles of Narnia books. Mm-hmm. Very religious. And so sets up the stage for historical drama that is very interesting in that these two characters have opposing worldviews and are going to hash it out in a scholarly manner. Seems interesting. So the final title card that plays before the credits says, Sigmund Freud, before his death, met with an instructor at some British institution. I think it was Oxford maybe. Not entirely sure that's what it was. But met with some Cambridge instructor. Yeah, one of these elite King's British schools. College. Nobody knows for sure if it was C.S. Lewis. So the entire... foundation of this movie is like, yeah, we think maybe it was this guy. incredibly ridiculous to cap off a ridiculous movie. I only have a few more because we're just going through them. The Teacher's Lounge. Watch The Teacher's Lounge. We watched at Sundance a movie called Radical. You liked Radical, right?
I did a lot, yeah.
Yeah, and so the Teacher's Lounge is kind of a subversion of that kind of story. So it is a teacher that is trying her best, that is trying to do the best for the school, for the students. She catches an administrator at the school stealing, and then the entire student body turns against her.
Oh, no.
Because they have affinity for this administrator. And so it is this sort of like reverse of those kind of movies where the teacher trying her best fails miserably at every turn. Really good movie. Best movie I saw at AFI Fest is a movie called Perfect Days. And this is Wim Wenders. You might know him as the director of Paris, Texas. German guy, first ever, believe it or not, first ever non-Japanese person to direct a movie nominated by Japan to be their submission for the Oscars. So this is about a guy who cleans toilets for a living. And like low-key, this movie is just about like seeing the coolest public bathrooms that Japan has to offer. There's a lot of really wild ones. There's one where like the glass fogs up when you lock the door. There's one where the whole thing is like made of wood branches. It, on its own, just beautiful, amazing. And then it's just sort of the story about being content in your life and enjoying the simple moments of life. And it is
very difficult to do.
I know, but this movie will really make you believe. Really incredible. One of the most annoying characters ever put to screen is a guy that works with the main character. So I'm excited for you to see that. I think you'll really like it. And then the last one I want to talk about is The Taste of Things, which is France's nominee over Anatomy of a Fall. Basically about this like chef in the 1800s in France, and he's in love with like his, you know, sous chef is what you would call her, I guess. Juliette Binoche plays the sous chef. And it's just this really beautiful sort of allegory about cooking for, like, cooking as love and the attention you pay towards recipes and, like, your craft as the attention you pay to the, like, the person that you choose and that you love. And it's incredible. Incredible. Yeah. AFI Fest, I think, was an unqualified success. I think the only movies I really didn't care for were Maestro and Freud's Last Session, but everything else is going to end up in the top half of this year or the top half of next year if they come out next year. So I would recommend just about any of them.
Best AFI you've attended?
I don't know, because the last AFI I attended, I saw The Worst Person in the World, which was my favorite movie of that year. And I will say Perfect Days was amazing, not my favorite movie of the year, and wouldn't be in any other year, but it is very, very good. So I think like the top end of it, maybe not, but just in terms of depth of quality, I think the movies that we saw were excellent.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, we are both pretty big fans of that film festival. We're going to keep going. So
that's right. Hopefully every year if we can. All right. So Zach, we both spent October, you know, doing a film, I don't know, project sounds pretentious or whatever.
Mine was pretentious.
Yours was very pretentious, but it was a project. It was watching a horror movie every day of October, something that I could never do because I don't really like horror movies, so they would all be like cheesy comedy horror movies.
Also, I did not watch one every day. That was my intention, but I fell behind very quickly, and then I had to watch multiple on some days and then just make up the difference.
Well, let's just be honest. Unless you're Karsten on Letterboxd, it's really hard to watch a movie every single day.
Yeah,
people are busy, got jobs, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes you're just tired.
That's right. Always tired. I think that's your name on Blue Sky right now.
Yeah, it is.
So you want to talk to me about how that went?
Yeah. So actually, I took inspiration from someone else on Letterboxd who's been running this kind of Halloween October Horror Watch Party. I think this was the 10th year of it.
Wow.
And it's called Hooptober after Tobe Hooper, director of the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Cool.
And there's a bunch of rules and criteria that you follow.
Did you watch the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre?
That was my, yeah, that was my second watch of this.
But you also watched the new one.
Yes.
Okay.
But I had seen neither before. But anyway, that's Hooptober, but it starts on September 15th is when it's supposed to start. But I didn't start until like October 7th, which is also insane. And I still haven't verified my list to see if it met all those criteria, which isn't what I was going for anyway. I just was like, it's Halloween. There's a lot of horror like blind spots I want to fill. There were some horror movies that came out this year that I was interested in. So I wanted to just give myself a theme and a goal and see if I could meet that goal.
And proud to announce that you did.
Yeah, I did. Right under the wire on Halloween, I watched two movies to reach 31.
That is impressive, I will say. That, you know, and that's the best way to end it, you know, on Halloween, finishing the thing. I will say that I tried to watch a movie on Halloween, just to throw this out there. My girlfriend Anna and I, we watched The Corpse Bride. She's been like, let's watch The Corpse Bride for a while. And so I was like, okay, I've got hockey tonight. I had a game I had to go to. It was 10 o'clock. And so, you know, we start watching this movie a little before. We're like, we'll watch half before, half after. So we watch half of The Corpse Bride, go to my hockey game. We come back, 12:02. It has been removed from the HBO Max platform. And we're like, okay, I guess we're just going to watch half of The Corpse Bride. But sorry to interrupt your thing, but I just thought that was insane.
Yeah, no, I saw when you posted about that, and I thought that was really funny. Because, like, yeah, that sucks.
I was, like, so excited to finish it, and sure enough, couldn't do it.
Yeah. I'm just looking at something really quick about this, because I wrote a little quick write-up.
Okay.
Yeah, so only of 31 movies, only six of them I had seen before.
Okay.
So that means 25 movies.
What were the ones you'd seen before? Coraline?
Did you watch Coraline? I didn't watch Coraline.
You should watch Coraline.
I love Coraline. That's one of my favorite movies of all time. Get Out, and then tragically, The Hunt.
I still haven't seen that.
It's not good, but I love it for some reason.
Would you call that horror necessarily?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. I mean, you get kidnapped and then you get hunted for sport. That's pretty classic. And then it was also Nightmare Before Christmas.
I don't know if I'd call that horror either.
It's literally a Halloween movie.
Oh, Cody and I had this debate like a couple years ago on the podcast about whether it is a Christmas movie or a Halloween movie.
And
we
it's
each,
both.
We each took a side. It is. That's true. Yeah. That's fair.
The answer is both. But Halloween is explicit. The opening act of the movie takes place on Halloween.
It does.
So, yeah, Night Before Christmas. And also, this was like the 30th anniversary or something, and it was playing in theater, so I watched it in a theater.
So we're going to talk about AFI Fest here in a minute, and leaving one of the days, they were doing a live concert of the music from Night Before Christmas at the Hollywood Bowl, and it backed up traffic a ton. But like that just shows you the admiration people have for the movie, is that they were willing to, you know, sell out the Hollywood Bowl to see it perform live. But carry on.
Yeah, I mean, that's cool. Danny Elfman. The music's excellent.
It is.
Nightmare Before Christmas, and then Hereditary, Tucker and Dale versus Evil, and Midsommar, which another one I watched in theaters for the
first
time.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I watched that movie in theaters and regretted it the entire runtime.
Yeah, I've seen that one a few times. I typically watch it around Easter, but... No, when I saw that it was going to be in theaters this month.
Yeah, I vividly remember watching that in theaters because one of my friends during the previews was texted me and was like, hey, we're going to go get dinner. You want to come through? And I was like, I just sat down for Midsommar. And they were like, literally they responded, why would you do that to yourself? And sure enough.
Yeah. Honestly, watching it again, because it's been at least a year, maybe or longer since I've watched it. Definitely a new perspective, not just because it was on the big screen, but just things that I noticed.
You never saw that in theaters, I'm surprised.
No, I missed it. that was the year I think that I ended up getting the pass, like an AMC pass, but it had already exited theaters by the time I did.
Yeah.
So I missed that one.
But theaters. You saw Hereditary in theaters?
No.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. I saw both of those in theaters, and they chilled me to my bone.
Yeah, Hereditary would be cool on the big screen. But yes, yeah, so only those six I had seen before. Everything else was new. Like you mentioned, I did watch the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which I thought was fucking incredible.
Do you want to throw out, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5, whatever you feel like, recommendations, like things you saw that you're like, yes, this is something that maybe tailor it to me, someone that does not enjoy horror. I will watch horror movies if they are.
Did you watch Totally Killer yet?
I haven't. You know, one of my coworkers actually told me about this, so I am interested because it seems like it's a little more accessible than, you know, your standard horror things. A caveat for this podcast, my girlfriend is not interested in big scaredy cat. And I would call myself a little scaredy cat. I don't really like horror unless, you know, it is doing something a little bit bigger with the storytelling and the thematic, you know, resonance. And so that's when I will watch it. So among your list, is there anything you think that like I would enjoy?
I think Totally Killer's fun. It's a bit silly. I don't know if you've ever seen like Happy Death Day.
I have not.
But it's like it's got time travel, so you could sell it like it's like Back to the Future.
It's like Back to the Future.
It really is. They make references to Back to the Future because the main character, it takes place on Halloween. Her mother was a survivor of a grisly Halloween crime in the past.
Okay.
And her friend is doing the science project that ends up sending her back in time. And she tries to save her mother's friends because she's a bit stuck up, like a tight ass, I guess you would say, in the future about her daughter doing a bunch of stuff because all her friends got murdered when she was a teenager.
So she's trying to stop it.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then her journey in discovery about getting close to her mother. And
so it's like a horror comedy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. That sounds more. Is that streaming somewhere?
Amazon Prime.
Okay. Yeah. I would be down for that.
Yeah. The Hunt also.
You've told me about this before.
Yeah. It's so stupid. It's really dumb. It's like.
This was the movie, for anyone that doesn't remember, that got caught up in some.
It got delayed.
Political controversy because it was about like liberals hunting conservatives or something.
Against the MAGA people.
Yes. Right.
Which is just the most laughable thing. It's the most centrist movie of all time. Some of the jokes make me laugh. Honestly, I just really like Betty Gilpin in the movie. Like,
sure.
She gives this really deadpan performance of just like, you know, indifferent efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
Also, there's a lot of like stunt cameos. Like you have Emma Roberts.
Oh, okay.
And Ike Barinholtz.
Love Ike Barinholtz.
He does a really good job in this.
Earn my affinity after Blockers and we'll have it forever.
Yeah, he does a really funny bit in this where because the whole point is these conservatives who propagate conspiracy theories without, you know, any sort of critical thought, end up getting these liberals fired from their jobs because they made a joke about hunting them for sport, and then they were like,
cancel culture.
It's a real thing.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, these liberal people do hunt us for sport. It's real. They post online about it. They make connect all these dots that aren't really there. And then those people have to resign from their hedge fund management positions and their board seats and all this stuff. And so then they're like, fuck them. We're making it real. We're hunting them for sport. And it's got Hilary Swank in it. And they have this like final showdown with her and Betty Gilpin. It's a lot of like stupid, silly fun.
Yeah.
And if you don't take it seriously, like, it's, I don't know. There's just
it
something.
It seems
that
like it's not meant to be taken seriously.
I think it 100% is. Like, I think,
really?
I
okay.
think that the director, you know, I think they thought they were cooking here. And absolutely were not. It's not good. You get Glenn Harrington in there. He's funny.
Really? Like, okay. Yeah, I mean, have you seen Blackberry?
Yes. I love Blackberry.
Okay. Incredible performance.
A really good movie this year. Yeah. But so, yeah, I think it was meant to be 100% serious. And it just, it's very much like both sides and not good, but it's very tame horror as well and very funny in some parts. Like this, it just, I don't know. it's I guess you could call it like a guilty pleasure for me. Friday the 13th sucks. The original one, I did not like it.
Okay.
A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night is billed as horror, but it's not very horrifying.
It is among your favorites on Letterboxd.
Yeah, just today. Recently updated. There is a sequence in it which just absolutely broke my heart.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not because it's particularly sad, but because it's extremely like romantic.
Okay.
But yeah, it's about a lonely vampire. Very cool. And then, honestly, you know what? I was gonna recommend this to you earlier off the air, is One Cut of the Dead, and Blood Quantum.
I think One Cut of the Dead is maybe on my watch list. I've heard good things.
Yeah, these are both on Shudder, which I did a free trial to watch them. One Cut of the Dead is about a Japanese like film crew,
okay,
who are set out to make this zombie movie, and
sure.
Then the premise is they get attacked by real zombies while they're trying to do this. But it turns out, you know, and spoilers for One Cut of the Dead if you haven't seen it, but it turns out it's a double twist in which they're hired by a streaming channel called Zombie Channel to do this and then make it look like they get attacked by real zombies.
Sure.
So it's like this rug pull of like, oh, they're filming this movie, like found footage, and then they get attacked by real zombies. And it's another one where it's like, actually, that was the premise the whole time to launch this streaming channel. And then the rest of the movie is about how the first half that you saw, that was this found footage horror, was actually a film crew trying to like adapt to the challenges that they were facing, because it's all shot live. Like it's a live launch.
Sounds chaotic.
One cut. Yeah, and actually it super is. And so some of the stuff that like makes you scratch your head originally in like the found footage part, you realize is them adapting to something that went wrong and
right.
then trying to like
sounds like fun.
Fix it. Yeah, it's actually
heard good
really
things.
Cool. Yeah,
yeah,
really cool.
That's one I've been eyeing for a little bit.
And then Blood Quantum is a zombie movie that really, really goes back to the roots of like the original zombie movie, Night
okay.
of the Living Dead.
Sure.
Which was an allegory for racism. Same thing here, except it's colonialism, in which in Canada, this indigenous tribe that lives on this reservation across a bridge from, you know, regular civilization, the indigenous people are immune to a zombie virus that starts taking over all of the white people. And it's about how they like deal with it and then,
okay.
you know, try and build like a society and all this stuff. And it's got Forrest Goodluck, who was in How to Blow Up a Pipeline.
Oh, sure. Okay.
The indigenous character in that
yeah.
one as well. Who I'm a really big fan of after seeing both of those.
Sure.
But it's a really good movie. A good zombie movie, at least. Like, you know, some odd choices, but very, very good. Very cool premise. But yeah, I think that's really it. Like, also, When Evil Lurks was really good.
I heard good things, but I've heard it's extremely disturbing.
Yeah, absolutely. Some of the stuff that they do is just like, I'm curious if, and I might seek this out, like how they accomplish some of this stuff.
Yeah.
Because there's literally a moment in which a large dog like just destroys a little girl.
Jeez.
It's very horrific. Yeah.
Yeah. That but, sounds disturbing.
Yeah. I think what my plan for this is to do like kind of like a larger write up about some of my feelings.
Please do. And
stuff.
Then
yeah.
post it on the website,
especially When Evil Lurks, because as I was watching it, I was enjoying it, even though it was very squeamish especially that scene, it's very foreshadowing what's about to happen, and you're just like, no, no, please, no.
I'm very excited to add a tab on the website yeah. for Zach Reviews, so please do that.
Yeah, and it's just got it's saying some stuff about religion and, you know, the nature of evil, and
sure.
it's interesting. Yeah, and then Malignant was also fun.
Ridiculous film.
Absolutely.
That's a movie I have
yeah,
seen, ridiculous.
90 mile an hour horror movie, but fun twist and even
yeah.
funner reveal.
All right, Zach, so there's one more movie that I didn't talk about from AFI Fest, and that's because it was a Sunday movie that you saw as well, and we're going to talk about it here to close out the episode. And that is Cord Jefferson's American Fiction, starring Jeffrey Wright. I'm going to let you explain what this movie is about, because I think it is a little fraught, the plot itself.
It's, I mean, I think it can be summed up pretty easily. I was trying to explain this to a coworker of mine, because they had asked what I did over the weekend, and I told them, you know, I went to AFI on my one day off. And yeah, so this movie is about Jeffrey Wright. He plays an author.
Mm-hmm. His name is Felonious, something Felonious, but he goes by Monk.
Yeah, everyone calls him Monk, yeah. He's an author and a literature professor, and he has a bad day in which he berates a student and then gets suspended.
That's right.
From his job. And he hasn't written in a while, and the project that he's working on isn't really exciting to his agent or the publishers that they've been submitting it to. And he's dealing
with a very
this.
Intellectual writer, I think, is an important thing to qualify.
And he's black.
As. Yes.
And so he's dealing with this frustration of almost like a, not quite a writer's block, but people don't want to buy what he's selling, essentially. And as he's navigating this, his mother is clearly getting more and more sick with dementia.
Important thing to note, he finds this out because he goes back home to go to a book festival where the honorary book is written by Issa Rae's character.
Yeah.
And it is just like a very stereotypical book. Yes. About the black experience.
Mm-hmm. It is, that's where I was going. Yeah, so he decides to go home on his sort of forced vacation along with this book festival he's a speaker at. And yeah, Issa Rae's character is another author, black woman, who wrote a book kind of like The Blind Side or like pushed by Sapphire. You know, this traditional black pain novel that's very popular with white audiences and general audiences. And it's to his dismay. And so he's trying to take care of his mother and navigate being back home and, you know, feeling a bit sorry for himself. And eventually, out of like this frustration and anger, he just starts writing.
Satirically.
Yeah, satirically as a joke. He's just doing a bit here. a black pain novel that's sort of takes inspiration from his life a little bit, where dealing with like a sick parent and this kind of thing. And it's this hilarious like dramatization of it in the movie.
Which is incredible.
And then he, you know, he's drinking and he's writing and he just goes on one and sends it to his agent. And then the next morning, his agent's like, dude, those pages you sent over, everyone wants them.
Right. But the thing about the agent is that he's like, this is ridiculous at first. Mm-hmm. But then he sends them out and everyone's like, this is incredible.
Yeah. They get a response that none of his previous novels have ever gotten, you know, the highest offer.
He gets a call, I think, in one of the funniest moments of the movie is he gets a call from the, like, I don't know, some sort of American book authority that awards authors, and he's like thinking he's gonna win an award for one of his other books, but they're asking him to be on the panel to award something else. Mm-hmm. And then I guess the reveal is that his book becomes like his satirical book is one that
it becomes a late submission,
right?
So exactly like you said, initially, his agent is sort of in on it, like, oh, okay, I see why you did this, and they get the pages get sent out.
Yeah.
But it creates this insane response to actually produce the novel, which he goes forward with, and then it gets, you know, launched and becomes this massive critical success. He does publish under a pseudonym.
Yeah, and he only does it because he wants to help his mom.
Yeah, to pay for her medical bills and things like that, so... Yeah, he publishes under a pseudonym, so no one knows it's him, but it becomes this insane, successful novel. It takes, takes the nation by storm. And then these rumors get started about how he's like a wanted criminal, and that's why it's published anonymously. And then, of course, he does get asked to be on that panel, like a, you know, like a Pulitzer Prize kind of panel or something.
Yeah.
And the last edition is his novel, which then gets selected to win.
Yeah.
And yeah, just an incredible, incredible movie.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that, man, American Fiction, it is tough to say because, I don't know, like, it is satire in the purest form, right? And I have written extensively on this website, we've talked about it on this podcast, about how the last few years of, like, real life has made it feel like satire is essentially dead. Like, how do you parody something that is so excessive already? And I think that was a big problem that I had, maybe you as well, with like Don't Look Up or something like that. And I think this movie really nails the satire. Like, that is an experience that, you know, Cord Jefferson clearly has seen and wanted to express in this film, and it's just funny. Like, it leads with humor in a way. I think that I will say, like, in our screening, one of the things that I will know is I was sitting next to also a film critic that was probably the loudest, like, laugher in the entire. I'm sure you heard this guy laughing even from a few rows back. But some of the things that were laughed at, I think, felt like they were bait for, you know, uninformed people to laugh at.
Yeah.
And it was interesting to kind of see the dynamic of, like, what people thought was funny and what people, you know, didn't. And I don't know, I think there's a lot of depth in this movie about Monk's character and his family situation and what he goes through, but then also, like, you know, his exasperation. And we should say Jeffrey Wright is incredible in this movie.
I love Jeffrey Wright.
He's always
everything
great
he's ever done. Yeah,
but he's so good. Like, one of my favorite performances I've seen him in. He's just, like, so exasperated by the way the world has taken this book by storm. It's an absolute blast. And I think, like, probably, I would say probably the funniest movie of the year that I've seen.
Yeah, definitely up there.
Up there with maybe Theater Camp. I'm trying to think what else is, like, in that range of just, like, pure comedy.
Did you see You Hurt My Feelings?
You Hurt My Feelings. I don't think You Hurt My Feelings is excessively funny, though.
I mean, no, it's not. I wouldn't say it's excessively funny. It's not like you're not, you know, you're not in stitches watching it, but it's definitely funny.
Yes, I think so. And anything with Julia Louis-Dreyfus is going to be funny. But I think this movie has, like, just laughs per minute is, like, incredible. I think that, you know, I would say the same thing about Theater Camp as well. So just one of the funniest movies of the year. But I think, for me, what really put this up towards the top of the things that I saw this year and at AFI Fest is that it gets satire right. Like, it understands the ridicule of its entire premise and leans into that. And the characters going through it realize how ridiculous it is as well. It's excellent, an excellent film.
Yeah, no, it certainly is. And I had an excellent time watching it. It's just, it reminds me of a lot of, like, again, one of my recent faves that I updated is Sorry to Bother You.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this very sharply critical movie about, you know, certain societal forces and perceptions. It's not as aggressive as Sorry to Bother You. You know, that movie is a little bit more angry, I feel like.
Absolutely.
But yeah, it's just, it's so pointed and accurate. There's just so many little moments in that, like, resonate, you know, that I've seen, I've seen depictions of in other stories and online, certainly.
Yeah.
Of just these perceptions. And then what I really love about this movie as well, I think it has, like, the perfect ending.
Yes.
In which it does that thing where the characters are discussing the best way to end it.
Yeah.
Because he gets approached by a movie producer played by Adam Brody.
And this movie hasn't come out yet, so I wouldn't spoil exactly what they decide.
Yeah.
But yes.
Gets played by Adam Brody. Essentially what happens is he, you know, Jeffrey Wright's character stops trying to fight against the success of this.
That he does in every expression that he gives. He's just like tired of this shit.
He's so exasperated. And I guess we haven't mentioned that there's a sort of like a romance subplot in with a nearby a woman who lives nearby.
Yeah.
That sort of helps him kind of like accept success that, you know, he doesn't think he's worthy of, and also isn't like real success because of the nature of the writing. But he does let go a little bit, even though he's still holding on to this like reserve of resentment.
Sure.
But anyway, after the movie gets, you know, selected for this award, and he gets put in touch by his agent with a producer who's very interested in making this movie, which is played by Adam Brody. And also they have a very funny meeting. But he writes the screenplay for the novel, and he's working with the director, and he's on set, and they're talking about how – or it's not – he's on set for another movie, but – they're talking about how they should end this movie because it's like the third pass of the script or something. Sure. And he's like, you know, we got to do something about the ending. And then they discuss the possible endings. And it is just the most on-the-nose, satirical choice. And then the way it's played out is so funny because you've seen the sequence a few times already of the way that they're talking about it. And it's basically him accepting this award.
And different breaking, things that can happen.
Breaking his anonymity, and then what can happen based on that, and each one is very funny, and just seeing them in succession, and then the way that they end with, and then the final like moment is like, yes, that's the one. It's just, oh my goodness,
it's absurd at times. It's extremely funny. I'm just interested how it plays when it comes to audiences. I think this is a movie that is willing to meet just about every potential audience member where they are, and there's something to get out of it from that. I think that is a good thing on one level, but a bad thing on a certain level too, because I don't know how you felt watching this movie, but some of the biggest laugh lines were pretty like offensive things, or like, you know, cruel things. And it makes me wonder, like, when this gets out to the wider audience, like, I guess with satire, you always have to think about this, like, actually well-done satire. Will the audiences take the wrong message from this movie? And I don't think it's...
It's a matter of, like, are you laughing at the joke, or because you are laughing, like, that's real to you, like, that makes sense.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah. Are you in on the joke, or are you not? And... I agree. That's definitely something that, you know, satire certainly blurs those lines. I think, in my opinion, and maybe it's skewed because of I tend to be a little more generous with the kind of audience that would show up to this festival to watch this movie. I think it played well, you know.
I think so too.
But yeah, when it becomes more widely available. Who knows? And there will certainly be detractors.
Even this audience, there were points during this movie that I felt like there were lines that were supposed to kind of like hit you a little bit, like, oh man, that's brutal that people took as a joke.
Mm-hmm.
And some of that comes from the fact that this movie is setting up joke after joke after joke that is very funny. But I don't know. I think sophisticated audiences can see when
there's a lot of interesting conversations that happen. You know, I mean, I would go so far as to say that the initial meeting between Jeffrey Wright and Adam Brody is interesting, but also is very funny and probably darkly reflects real world experiences for Black screenwriters and creatives that are trying to get pictures made in the way that their content, or content is the wrong word, but like the way that their ideas or what they've written, what they've created is handled. It's played for comedy in this, and you know, I totally get what you mean, but also,
but I think even beyond that, I think there's a lot of interactions that happen between White characters misunderstanding his intentions for the film that gain huge laughs.
There's that are
meant to be, I guess, funny in a sense, but also are meant to be like poignant and devastating that like an actual person could think this.
Yeah.
And then there are moments that are genuinely funny between him and his family, who are of course all black, like family dynamic points that they make jokes, and the audience is just that we watch this with. There are a couple times I laughed in like interactions he has with like Sterling K. Brown's character
that I thought were very funny.
And then it was just a dead room. And I like you could hear the echo of the laugh that you give.
Yeah, when it's revealed that he is gay.
It's not even really revealed, it's just kind of a given throughout. Yeah. Like he reveals it right away, but then some of the weird things that happen.
Or yeah, when he has the two guys over his house. Yeah.
He's like, What the fuck are you doing here?
Yeah, he's in the beach house. Yeah. That was great. Yeah, there's a moment where he's talking with the publishers, and it's just two white executives who are like, oh, we hear you, we're listening, we want to do this. And then he's like making suggestions, and like, can we talk maybe about doing it this way? Yeah. And then I also
there's one moment where the jury for the book award is meeting and both Jeffrey Wright does not want his own book to win, and Issa Rae's character is like, this book is reductive and terrible in sort of the same way that hers is, which is a very funny dynamic in the thing that she thinks her iteration of this is literary and his is not. But then it's the two of them, and then it's three white people on the rest of the panel, and they all decide that this book, which is satirically he decides to like pull unless they title it fuck.
Yeah, yeah.
And they decide to do it, which is a very funny joke. They're pushing against it, and the white people in the room are like, this spoke to me, and I think yeah. I think it should be it. And it's like, and it's great that we listen to the voices of black people. And then that's exactly the kind of joke
that was completely silent.
Yes, but that's the kind of joke that I'm talking about, where it's like the white people in the film say something absolutely utterly ridiculous, and it's funny because that is the satire of it, but at the same time it's like devastating because then they pan over to Issa Rae.
They go to a wide shot.
Yeah. And it's just like that the two black people who oppose the book have no say in who's gonna win.
They lose the vote 3-2.
Right.
The only two votes being the black votes on the panel.
Exactly.
And they're like, yeah, it's just, I think that's so important that we listen to black voices right now, or that we elevate black voices.
Right, exactly.
God damn it. Yeah. That's brutal. And very, very quiet moment in the theater.
Yes.
Certainly. I think that conversation that follows after that is interesting too, between him and Issa Rae, where
I think it precedes it.
Yeah, you might be right. Yeah. Where she vocally opposes awarding this book, and then he makes note of it. And then after everyone else leaves, he's like, why are you? I know why I oppose this. Why do you?
He makes the exact, like, explicit case, like, how is this different than your book?
Mm. Yeah, because her book's called, like, We Lives in the Ghetto or something.
Exactly.
And it's all in, you know, African-American vernacular.
Right.
And
which, when she gives the interview, she does not speak that way at all. No. It's just she is a well-educated person that speaks, you know. Yeah, exactly. And It is. I really, really enjoyed this movie, and it pains me a little bit because I can see the misinterpretations of it, and I can see the faults in it. But it is so funny, and it is so biting and smart in its satire. And again, like I said, I have been writing on the website for a couple years now about the just absolute dearth of satire that we've gotten in cinemas lately, and I think this movie, for whatever faults it has, absolutely nails the satire. And it's such a joy to see when somebody just understands the genre that they're going for and gets it. And Jeffrey Wright is incredible. Issa Rae is very funny.
Sterling K. Brown is
hilarious. Everyone in this movie is so funny and knows what they're after, and it is, I don't know, go back and read. I implore anyone to go read my review of Don't Look Up, and just the absolute failure that movie is as a satire, and then watch American Fiction and see, you know, again, whatever faults it has, see the way that it just skewers American culture as it exists today. And I think it's amazing.
You want to round it up?
Yeah, let's round it up. I give it 4.5 stars.
I think that might be where I landed to, or if not 4. Yeah, I just gave it a solid 4.
Yeah. It's on that 4.5. I think it's my lowest rated 4.5 star movie of the year. But it is, you know, up there. So
wait, Early gave it 2.5. That's interesting.
He didn't like it. But, you know, a couple other critics did care for it a great deal. And, you know, there's always the element, and we can talk about that maybe at another point. But, you know, we saw this at a film festival, and you have a certain expectation of the films you see at a film festival. And I don't know. We were in the Chinese theater for Maestro, so.
Yeah, he also didn't like Maestro, so.
Neither did we. So, you know, we're back and forth on it. All right, Zach, I think that's going to do it for this episode. Excited to get more stuff out to everybody. And, you know, follow us on Blue Sky, I think, is the next thing.
Yeah, where we're going to be at moving forward.
I'm EvanD26.
Painted Dog on Letterboxd.
Yes. Also on Blue Sky, I'm EvanD26, and you're Mind Vultures, I think.
Yeah.
So Letterboxd, Blue Sky. We're going to try and get things out a little more consistently going forward once we catch up. I'm still working through the backlog on spinningthereel.com. Please write something for your Halloween write-up.
Yeah, sure.
I think that would be great.
I'd like to. I've been talking about it for a while.
I think. Promise the people right now you're going to write a top 10 of the year.
Top 10 of the year, for sure. I can do that.
Yes, let's do it. Okay. Yeah, otherwise, just rate us, review us. Share it with your friends. And I don't know, you have anything else to say?
Yeah, thanks for listening.
Bye.